Hey, what's going on? It's Bill Burr, and it's time for the Thursday afternoon, just before Friday, Monday morning podcast. And I'm just, now, I'm not just checking in on you. I usually am just checking in on you, seeing how your work week's going, the cubicle battles and all of that shit. But every once in a while, we have a special guest, and this is one of these Thursdays. We have the one and only Steve Gorman, drummer from the Black Crowes. Drummer with Trigger Hippie that has a new album out called Full Circle, and he's here to promote his new book, which I mentioned, got an advance copy.
You did.
Old Hollywood Bill over the summer. It's called Hard to Handle, The Life and Death of the Black Crowes, and welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you, sir.
And I got to tell you, dude, I've read... I'm not a big reader.
Here we go.
I am not a big reader.
Here we go.
And I have read, you know, I read autobiographies of like Ken Stabler.
What does it say about me that most people that like the book go, first of all, I don't read much.
Yeah.
But
yeah. Yeah.
Your book.
Yes, I know.
It's probably. I'm waiting for the reading people to tell me it's good.
Yeah.
But the non-readers, I got them.
You got me. So I've read a bunch of rock docs all the way back. I think one of the first ones I ever read was like Hammer of the Gods, which is just a total
shit show.
That was a horseshit fucking book. Saying how they want the devil and all that. And I've this I'm telling you, this is the one. As far as like if everybody, you know, they read the books to see, hey, what was it really like?
Did they
get along and all of that? And I got to tell you, man, the fucking vibe of this book, I just felt like I was friends with you for 20 years. We were in a pub. Yeah. Everybody had cleared out, and you just let it out because it's just like there's so many epic lines.
Yeah.
Thank you. One where the Jimmy Page thing falls apart, and you just go, I'm not going to say names or anything like that. I mean, go read it.
Go get the book.
Shit, but it's just like the Jimmy Page thing falls apart. Like the way that you tell that story when you were going to the payphone. It was at Hyde Park in London. It was just like, I just felt like I was like, oh my God, this guy, if somebody asks him directions, might murder somebody.
Yeah.
And I just got to say, you know, as far as like, you know, when guys write these books, because, you know, there's always been these, this band is done, it's fucking over, we're signing contracts and all this shit. And then there's always that, you know, the farewell tour is sort of the big joke in music. And so I always feel like when I read these books that there's always that feeling of hope, well, maybe the band's going to get back together. So I can't quite tell it the way I would tell it if I had a few pops in me. But I don't feel that with this book, Steve.
I'm not going back. Let me put it that way. I mean, I'm not, you know, thankfully, when the band blew up in 2014, and for the reason we blew up, which was our singer decided after 27 years, I'll just demand all the money. That I don't know how you go back from that. You know, I don't know. For me personally, no, that's done. We're done. Like, there's not a chance in hell that you're gonna upend the apple cart like that.
How does it happen where like when the band starts out, I always feel like you guys. It always seems like with the bands, you guys are just starving. You're riding in one van. You just you're like this platoon with this common goal. Let's just get.
That's how
up
I saw
this,
it. Yeah, that's how I thought mountain. It was.
At what point? Is it now that you look back going, oh, that was the moment? Or did you sense along the way when you start seeing cracks in it and people, what I always call it, like taking the ride, where all of a sudden it's just like, hey, you know what? When I say go fuck yourself, it means a little more now. And you start, you just start floating away. Like whoever's like those hot air balloon guys that hold the thing down, they just sort of let go and you just float off into the abyss.
I started seeing cracks very early, but what I look at them now as, it's not cracks into the foundation of what the band was. It's cracks into the foundation of what I thought the band was.
Oh, okay.
Everybody was already who they were. And everybody responded to our success and our workload and all that in the way that their nature dictated. It just took me forever to recognize, oh, they were always that way. I thought, you know, it's easy to say, oh, fame and fortune fucks with people.
Oh, so you don't go with that.
It just throws gas on a simmering fire that's already there to begin with. I mean, you know, it's like when Mel Gibson gets drunk, he said things. I've been drunk. I didn't say those words.
Right.
You know what I mean? I've been that drunk and I've been that angry and I don't go there because that's not me.
Right.
And so all fame and fortune and all that success of our early records was a mirror for everybody. And so what I got out of the mirror was you know, a lot of uncertainty and a lot of, you know, my response to people splintering off was to panic and freak out. And like I've said a million times, a band is a family. And when a band start, when a band starts with family, it's really a family.
Right.
And when you have addiction in a family, you have codependency in a family. And so everybody brings their own bags to the shit show. You know what I mean? And mine was, you know, I'm a codependent guy who thinks I can make everything better.
Right.
Like, oh, here are the Robinson brothers, and they have their views and their issues. And I stepped in, and then we grabbed a guitar player, and then we grabbed a bass player. Everybody brought their own shit. And so when the cracks start to appear, I look at it now as, oh, no, that's just – that was reality tapping me on the shoulder, but me going, not yet, not now. I don't want to know. I'm gonna will this into a better place.
Well, I have to say, the amount of times in the book – only reason because I'm a fan of the band, so I knew you weren't done. But the amount of times I got to give you got to give it up to what you guys accomplished as far as the amount of times that you're right there and then just something fucks the whole thing up. And it's just like, oh, we're done. And then just something else came along. No. Like maybe that happens twice if you're lucky. But the amount of times that happened to you guys, because that's the one thing that's only sad about reading the book. It's just like I fucking love the band. I love everybody in it. But like. But on the other side, it really was amazing to just finally kind of have somebody just go, all right, this is what the fuck happened. And this guy, you know, this fucking asshole, he said this and this shithead. And then I'm fucking like, I mean, it's basically how the thing is. It sounds like a conversation. So and I was I'm really geeking out here about questions I want to ask you. But as far as like what it's always killed me as far as like if there's this huge band like your band and you got this killer drummer like you, the thing about it is if you're like a killer singer, you're like the way people listen to music, it's like it's the singer first.
Sure.
So they, in a lot of people's minds, if you listen to it on like a superficial level, they're the sound of the band.
Yeah.
So a guy like that can go out and get a bunch of hired guns.
Of course, yeah.
And do that type of shit. But then people always say about the drummer is like, your band's only as good as your drummer. If your drummer sucks,
it's true.
You're fucked. But like, I feel like...
Well, name a great band with a shit drummer. They don't exist.
I know.
There are great bands whose singers weren't great.
Yes,
you know what I'm saying. There's like
I'm
bands.
I'm a fan of few of those bands.
Yeah, but a band that you but an all time in the all time thing. I have a buddy back in Atlanta, Teddy Murray, and he always said, "You got a singer and a drummer. Everybody else can fake it."
Right,
and it's kind of true on a certain level.
But the thing is, when the band implodes, though, as far as a drummer then trying to be like, "Well, I'm the drum sound of the Black Crowes," to try and get another thing going. Like I was. You know, when you were saying, yeah, this panic, I can make it better, I can fix it.
Yeah.
Was any of that like, well, I'm the fucking drummer. Who's going to give a shit? If this thing, everybody goes and goes solo, this guy's the lead singer. He's like the face. He's always running his yap in the interviews. So he's kind of like up front in the fame thing and can kind of sustain something.
Right.
Because
I honestly never thought. I had fears that were primal of just my thing is splintering.
Right.
Now, when I took a minute and said, well, what happens if this goes away? I was like, oh, well, I can get another gig. I'm good. And I'm a great member of a team. I mean, I knew what my strengths were.
Right.
And I knew that I could use those elsewhere. I didn't want to go through that because I always had the vision of, you know, I dropped out of college and moved to Atlanta to start a band. And the bands I loved. One thing at a time. I got to get into a band before I can commit to buying a drum kit. But the main thing I wanted to do my whole life was being a band. And a band to me is no different than a basketball team. I mean, I really looked at it like that. Mm-hmm. And I looked at it like, I'm Bill Russell. And most basketball fans don't appreciate his greatness. So I get it.
Right.
I'm going to defend the rim. I'm going to get every fucking rebound. I'm going to hit all the outlet passes. And you guys go dunk and shoot threes. And I love that role. That's me. I got it.
That's why people love playing with you.
I got it. I got this. You guys go do what the fuck you want. I'm not going to ever miss the one.
Right.
We're going to be right where we need to be. And so that's how I played basketball. That's how I played soccer. I played sweeper. I was just like, I got all this, and I don't want all the attention. I'm happy to, like, let's go.
Right.
And then when I saw Chris my second night in Atlanta sing, and I was like, that fucker's got something. You know, like, holy shit. And a few months later, when he asked me to play with them, me and Rich and Chris, you know, me and two brothers, but then Chris and I were like best friends. You had these two weird, you had brothers that were at each other's throats, and then I step in, and me and Chris became inseparable, and we're just bad cop, good cop, whatever you want to call it, having a fucking blast. But then he's got his brother. So there was that dynamic of those two little two-man crews within the three of us. That was very powerful. Looking back now, it's real. There was a lot of chemistry and power in that.
Right.
Because we all brought a real intensity to it. And we didn't know what to do with it, and it took a while to figure it out, and we needed help to figure it out. But it was built on a pretty strong – there's talent, but there's also desperation, and there's a lot of fuel to make sure this fucking thing goes somewhere. And that was all really special. So from the jump, I was like, I'm in a band with brothers. This ain't about me on any fucking level publicly. Behind the scenes, though, we're all here together, and by God, I'm going to have my say, and I'm going to will these things into – and in a local band, that was much more easy to do. And so I always wanted it to be that way. Like that idea of, you know, if everybody knows their role, nothing will ever stop us.
When was the first time you were in that band? And, you know, I mean, you have to go into it thinking I'm going to make it.
100%. I'm to this day convinced if I'd stayed in my original band, that band would have made it.
Yeah. That's the only way you have to think.
Well, I mean, I've manifested a lot of shit from nothing. And I realized early on, if you just tell people you're going to do something, it helps you to get it done. So go public with your stupid dream.
I said it.
Yeah.
That's why I haven't drank this whole year. I just told everybody at the beginning of the year, I'm taking this year off.
I did this. I'm 2 years off. And I just said, I'm done. And I had to keep saying it, but then it gets real easy. But like I
kind of like watching people get drunk too. It's funny.
It's funny.
It's like, and I didn't think I could go into a bar. There is some times.
Yeah.
You know, I had a couple of shows in Carolina, North Carolina. And after my second show, Asheville, they both went good. I was trying out the new hour and shit. And I got off stage. I was just like, oh, man,
this is a time for a beer.
Right? Oh, no, a bourbon.
A bourbon, better.
Yeah. And we were going to Clemson, Florida State the next day. And we rented this house on a fucking lake and shit. And it was just cigars. The whole thing was there.
Yeah, yeah.
And the guy next door had moonshine, and I was just like, I was just like, can I justify this for the experience?
Yeah,
but I didn't do it. So, but anyway, so you manifest things. This is great for my listeners too, because I have I get a lot of questions and everybody, and they're like, you know, hey, I want to do this. Can I do this? Is it too late to do this? And the answer is always, I've just been like, no. I mean, you want to be a high jumper at 80? Yeah. It's too fucking late.
The saying, the best time to have a great idea is 5 years ago.
Yeah.
I love that. But it's true. But you're going to be around. 5 years goes fast now. And so, you know, I mean, from being in a band to then, you know, I moved to L.A. in 2002 for a few years, and I had this idea for a TV show. Now, the end of the story is nothing happened, but a whole lot of shit happened to get to a place where nothing happened.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I pitched, I got deals in place, I put things in. It was like, it was in development for a week, and then it stopped, and then people got fired. But that process really taught me that, you know, there's a whole, and I had already learned this, but I still learn it. There's a lot of people that just don't do, they just don't go. And so life rewards action. That's been my thing for a long time.
Yeah.
Now, sometimes the reward is you get your shit kicked out of you. But there's, you know what I mean? Sometimes the reward is you get a deal or a door opens.
But you learn how to pitch a show.
That's what I mean. You learn how to pitch.
You learn how to spin. My show didn't get picked up.
You learn how to condense ideas. Exactly. But I'm now on my second, like I have a radio show, Steve Gorman Rocks. It's a nationally syndicated classic rock show. After I had a nationally syndicated sports talk show. And those things both started from me telling a guy, hey, man, I mean, my radio sports short talk radio career started because I sat in on an afternoon show in Nashville a couple times, and I'm the rock guy coming in who knows a little bit about sports, and I can speak in complete sentences, so everyone's always underestimating you.
Right.
I come in, I tell some jokes, I'm funny, they like it. The PD of the station goes, man, you want to come back next week? I could get you on once a week, and we could even get a sponsor, give you $100 or something. And I went, no, actually, I'd rather have my own show. Which as I said it, I'm like, what the fuck am I saying? And he goes, what's the show? And I said, it's Musicians Talking Sports. And this is in Nashville. This is 10 years ago, 11 years ago. And he goes, well, yeah, I kind of see that. You know, we have a lot of musicians want to sit in. Do you think you could really host a show? And I said, yeah, man, I was going to be a sportscaster. I was a broadcasting major in college. That was always the plan.
Right.
And I've got this idea. I've had it forever. Not true. Sounded great at the time.
Right.
And 10 days later, I'm like, this is Steve Gorman Sport. I'm on the air going, what the fuck am I doing?
It's happened a lot to you. Like, I remember reading in Modern Drummer.
Yeah.
Fucking late 80s.
30 years ago.
I didn't want to date myself. 30 years ago. And I remember you had a quote in there. You would be, like, the band had that that first album that came out, and you'd been playing drums for only like 3.5 years. You went
I bought my first kit in March of 87, and Shake Your Money Maker came out in February of 90.
I mean, it's insane.
I recorded it in the summer of 89. So I'd been playing for 2 years when we made that first record.
And went into a studio, had to play to a click.
Well, I went into a studio the first time to do a demo for A&M Records, and I've been playing for 3 months.
Jesus Christ.
And was just like, okay. I mean, well, but you know what, though? Like a lot, but unlike a lot of musicians, I mean, I have my problems. I have a weird family dynamic. Whatever. Everyone's got their shit they bring in and their issues. But I didn't have an issue of who the fuck am I? Mm-hmm. I knew who I was. And my playing was always, I always played like I played basketball. Like, just fucking be confident. You can fuck up, but don't question yourself.
Right.
And so when I play, and same in soccer, when I played sports, I would be nervous before a game and I'd be like, oh, we're going to get our shit kicked, you know. But once the game started, things slowed down and I just did at least, I always knew what to do. And if I made a mistake, I just, oh, I fucked that up. But it wasn't because I didn't know what to do. It's because I didn't execute.
Did the guy recording know that you'd only been playing for 2 years or no?
Well, my first demo was I wasn't even in Mr. Crow's Garden yet. They mm-hmm. had their drummer left to go join another band that got a record deal. So Chris just was like, dude, come play this demo for us. And I said, I've only been playing for 3 months. He goes, no, come on, you can do this. And he said, you're as fucking good as anybody else around here. So I went into the studio. I went into a studio with a guy, and I walked right over to the producer. His name was Steve Grumbach. And I said, man, I've been playing for 3 months. I am so far in over my head. So you just tell me what to do, I'll do it. But I have no... I'm flying blind, mm-hmm. but I also had a confidence that I knew how to play and I could always play a straight beat. Like, and I also, because I was starting at 21, I was smart enough to go, I didn't have those Keith Moon years in the basement by myself, like every other drummer, yeah. like Bobby Brady's just yeah. going crazy.
Yeah.
So I was making up for lost time. So I knew I just got to play straight beats, man. I didn't play a fill for a year and a half. I just played straight and yeah. and tried not to speed up. That to me was my success level. And I could do that, and I could hit hard. And so I'd go see local bands, and the drummer would be good. But by the third song, you could see he was like, he's out of shape. And then he was starting to question himself. And I'd see drummers fuck one thing up, and the rest of the gig sucked.
You can see that.
Oh, right. I always knew that. Because I'd been obsessed with drums. I watched drummers my whole life. I played in my head forever. Right. I really did. And I always knew if I ever do it, this is how I'm going to do it. I spent... Right. years thinking about that.
That's what you said in the thing. You know, I've only been playing for 3.5 years, but I spent a lot of years thinking about playing drums.
Very obsessively.
Like, I was like, what does that mean? You did something right.
I had a double life. I mean, right. I was living a full life, but really my brain was like, okay, so just always remember when you come out of that fill, you don't want to hurry around the toms. You got to keep it in time. I mean, I would literally go to gigs in college and see bands, and that's what I'd be watching the drummer the whole time. Thinking, I'm gonna do that one day, and I already knew I was late. I always knew I was starting late. So like, I don't have time to make mistakes.
I've always been late. I started comedy late.
Yeah,
I stayed back in first grade. took me forever to get through college. I became a dad late.
That's how I feel.
Yeah, always behind.
I'm the eighth kid of eight. And so right. I started kindergarten at like whatever. I mean, I graduated high school and my first week of college, I turned 18. So, right. but I was always the youngest kid in my class, and I always felt like I was behind everybody. Cause at first and second grade, you know, 10 months is a huge difference yes. in development. So my sports came a little later. Like I had brothers that were great athletes and I was where I should have been, but I felt like I was way behind where I should be, you know? So I always felt like I'm not there yet. And the drumming thing was the first time I ever was at least prepared to be late. Like right. I knew.
All right. Hey. I got to do the advertising here. All right. Oh, but MeUndies, no more sweaty balls. MeUndies. Steve Gorman used to work at a mall. All right. Selling it. I don't know. Ghost noises. Yes, please give us your rendition of what ghost noises are. That's your piece of shit old house settling. It's a galvanized pipe that's about ready to burst. That's been my experience. It's the most wonderful time of the year, Halloween. It's the most wonderful time. Remember when planning your costume as a kid was like the most fun you could have pre-Christmas? And now that you're an adult, Halloween feels less Halloween-y. Am I right? Okay, people who say, am I right? Well, MeUndies is bringing back the childlike joy of picking out the perfect costume with their spooky prints and Halloween costume onesies. That's right, costumes, onesies. Boo. That's what they wrote there. They're spooky soft, like designed to be the best thing you've ever put on your body soft, like softer than a fluffy kitten dressed up in a pumpkin costume. Pumpkins are rather hard in my world. Like softer than the brains zombies love to eat. Well, you get the idea. These are the softest undies known to man, and they're also available in all sizes, extra small, 4XL to 4XL. Soft for all. If you don't feel like leaving your house, that's cool too. Just wear the Halloween costume onesie to pass out candy, and you're good to go. MeUndies has a great offer for my listeners. For just first-time purchasers, get 15% off and free shipping. This is a no-brainer, especially because they have 100% satisfaction guarantee. To get your 15% off your pair, free shipping, and 100% satisfaction guarantee, go to MeUndies.com/Burr. That's MeUndies.com/Burr. All right. Lastly, but not leastly, Helix. Helix? There's nobody on the planet like you, Snowflake. So why would you buy a generic mattress built for everyone else? Next, please mention all the talking points below. I always do. If you type it, I will read it. Helix. Helix Sleep built a sleep quiz that takes 2 minutes to complete, and they use the answers to match your body type and sleep preferences to your perfect mattress. Whether you're a side sleeper, a hot sleeper, gross, like a plush or firm bed, with Helix, there's no more guessing or compromises. Just go to helixsleep.com/Burr, take their 2-minute sleep quiz, and they'll match you to a mattress that will give you the best sleep of your life. For couples, Helix can even split the mattress down the middle, providing individual support needs and feel preferences for each side. Helix Sleep was even awarded the number one best overall mattress pick of 2019 by GQ and Wired Mattress, and CNN called it the most comfortable mattress they ever slept on. Well, Lord knows they slept on it during the last election. Oh, Bill, when are you going to let it go? Those bastards, they should have hyped Bernie Sanders. They have a 10-year warranty, and you can try to get... They have a 10-year warranty, and you get to try it for 100 nights risk-free. There was too many small words in that sentence. Fucked up my brain. Right now, Helix is offering up to $125 off mattress orders for our listeners. Get up to $125 off helixsleep.com/Burr. That's helixsleep.com/Burr for up to $125 off your mattress order. Helix, helixsleep.com/Burr.
And so, anyway, getting back to that first session, I said to the guy, look, I don't know what I'm doing. And he goes, well, we just got to find a pocket. And I was like, okay, cool. What's that? And he goes, the pocket. You just find a groove and stay there. I go, oh, well, I can do that. And we played the song a few times, and he came out. We played him the song. Mm-hmm. And he goes, dude, you're fine. Just do exactly what you just did. And right. And just if you don't speed up and if you can play steady, it's going to be fine. Because he's a good producer, know what to do. I probably played 4 or 5 takes, and he goes, you're done. Drum track's great. We got it. And I'm like, holy shit, that went well.
This is easy.
Yeah, yeah.
I can do this.
Well, how many comedians kill their first time on stage? And then, you know, I've done that. I got up at Zany's in Nashville, Jumped up, and had a 10-minute thing. And I was like, holy shit, I could be a comedian. And then I went back, and it was awful. And I was like, no, I couldn't.
Well, the second time you went up, were you thinking about the first time?
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought,
then you're
this.
Not present.
Of course.
I did that this past weekend. I do it. Yeah, you're like, oh my God, I got 2 hours of new material. Wait a minute, it's 17 minutes.
Yeah, right.
Because you just, you're not like, you kind of get out of that flow. But to get back to the book, I know you've told all those stories and everything. What just for something different, what was the high point for you? Like, what gig? You're sitting back there, the band's just on, it's the album, the gig, or whatever. Where you were just sitting there going, like, wow, look at this thing that we built. I can't believe.
The summer of 93, we were in Europe doing festivals and headlining like Glastonbury and all these giant festivals.
Wow.
And we go from festival to festival. Backstage, it's all trailers. And we carried a giant tent with us that was bigger than this room. It was like a military tent for the generals to hang out in.
Okay.
And we attached it off the trailer. And it was, we had rugs down, beanbag chairs, lava lamps, hookah pipes, stereo the size of a fucking, you know, you could run a gig through it.
That sounds awesome.
I mean, we filled it with vibe. And everywhere we went, that was where all the other bands would congregate. They'd come over. We had cases of beer and all liquor. And I mean, it was just, it was the central location backstage. So there were shows where I'd be in there. I'm drinking a beer. It's 4 hours before we're even going to play. And there's like Sinead O'Connor and a couple guys from Def Leppard and some European dance band I've never heard of is on the bill. And then some German punk band and then a kid from Ugly Kid Joe.
Right.
And they're all in our tent. And we're, you know, and we were always very, despite being a pack of drunken wolves most of the time, in those settings, we were always hospitable. We did have that weird Southern, like, oh well, come on in. You gotta put out a spread,
right?
And we always had that. You know what I mean? Like, you might get yelled at in there, but you were gonna come in and drink our beer. And there was also in play a little bit of the power dynamic of look what we had. You know, we were feeling it. But that whole summer, there was that feeling of like, I mean, headlining Glastonbury on our second album, it was like, motherfuck, man, we have made it. You know, like this is, and the band was at its best. Like, it was all clicking right then.
Could you think stuff like that during a show? Like, wow, this show is going really good. Or would you be worried that would zap you out of whatever zone you were in that you were playing?
No, I was in a different, I didn't think of it in those terms. I mean, I would, you could see a crowd response and you could see either good or bad, but no, in those days I was way more, I stepped into a bubble zone that was all
just
about what
in.
It was locked in, and I'm listening to everybody else. Every stroke is the most important thing I'm ever going to do.
Right.
You know, if I break a stick and getting another stick out of the bag, either right or left, if that means I'm dropping, if I'm not going to hit that snare with full force, there's only one person in a field of 60,000 people that knows it, and it's me, but it fucks me up.
Wow.
You know, the other guys in a band wouldn't even know, but I'd be like, motherfucker, you know, just so, I mean, then the second the show's over, it's gone and I'm out and I don't even remember what happened. And wow. So when the band was, when I had gigs like that, that's what it was all about. It was never about, look at those people cheering. That was great.
Right.
And of course I like that. I prefer them to have a great night than not. But the thing that you can never replace, and the thing that once the band lost, it could never get back, is that there's an essence to six people going on stage and all going into some weird cocoon. And when it's over, not only is the audience really thrilled and happy, but we just did something that I can't talk about in a linear place. And then in about 10 minutes, I'm not even going to remember it. It's like a drug trip. It really is.
Was a collective feeling, too. And you guys would get off stage like, dude, I'm...
Yeah.
We
could walk to the stage having fights and arguments and really, really... I mean, literal punches being thrown and go fuck yourself. Well, that's a walking to the stage. Really? Well, if I'm such a pussy, take a shot, motherfucker. And
ladies and gentlemen, the Black Crowes.
Truly. I'm not exaggerating. You came to see us at Bottle Rock in 2013, festival in Northern California.
Oh, yeah.
And you walked up to the stage with us. I don't know if you remember
this. No, I remember.
And you were going...
That doesn't happen to me a lot.
And you were going, you're just going to go play? Don't you need some time? And
that's right. You were just shooting the shit
with
me.
And I was like, dude, what? We're going to... I've played a few gigs. And then I was talking to you and the crowd, everybody else in the band's already walking to their places, and I'll see you in a bit. And you were looking at me like, what are you fucking doing? Yeah. But I was like, it's what we do, you know? But there's been those exact same moments where you'd have seen either the brothers or even sometimes me and with Chris going, no, I tell you what, how about this? How about you go fuck yourself? And then walking out to start the show. And it didn't matter because you get a couple songs in, and if it's going well, there could be moments where between songs, Chris and the brothers were to be arguing, right? And then I would go, hey, why don't you both fuck off? You're both wrong, okay? Mm-hmm. There's 20,000 people here that don't care about you or you. What they care about is the next song. Can we start it? And then they'd both go, fuck off. And then I would just count it in. You know,
And then
halfway through that song, everyone's smiling again because something could have happened that immediately it's over. It's gone. Didn't mean a thing.
That's what I was going to ask. If you play and he's liking what you're playing, even if you just said, go fuck yourself, is he going to turn around and smile? Does that feel? So that feeling transcends
all the bullshit.
During
at the best of times, yeah. In the mid-90s, we would go up and down throughout a gig, and you'd have a high and then a low and then a high and a low. And if it ended on a high, if by the encore everything was right back where it was supposed to be, nothing else mattered.
All right, can you tell this story? This is one of my favorite that blew me away. Is the when you guys were opening for the Stones, how well the Rolling Stones have exiting a football stadium?
It's amazing. We're playing in Europe in '95 with the Stones on the Voodoo Lounge tour, and we finished with two nights in Basel, Switzerland. And so at the end of the tour, doesn't even sound real.
I know. Basel, Switzerland.
They said, "Hey, you know, come back to our hotel, and you know, we'll hang." Like Woody, Ron Wood, is like, "Come over and we'll have a drink," you know, and which means a lot more than a drink. And so we do our set, they're playing their show, and then at some point, about 20 minutes before their set ends, we're told just be on stage and be ready to await instruction. And
this is so cool.
And so we're standing on the side of stage. And they had a scrim that came down right behind the drum kit, a black scrim. That was like a two-way mirror, essentially. The audience just saw a black wall, but you could stand right behind it and see everything.
Wow.
So I would stand. I was this close to Charlie Watts, but invisible. I was right behind
him. Basically doing an arm's length.
I'm right behind Charlie Watts for shows. And Keith would come over and stand in front of Charlie, facing Charlie. So Keith is looking directly at me, essentially. Right. And they'd lock in for an entire song, and I'd just stand there. And when they lock in, it's 1972 all over again.
Yeah.
There's a story. Charlie's got that old Gretsch kit, right? Same kit. There's a story in the book where me and Rich are standing there and they do Monkey Man and Keith never moves. He stares at Charlie for the whole song. They just grooved. And me and Rich just looked at each other and didn't say a word, but we had a real thing of like, man, we're like that. Like we understand that.
Yeah.
Even saying it now, man, I can still like get goosebumps. Like we had those, they had that thing, and then we were like, man, fucking, when we're on, we got, you know, it's this really great beacon to us. Like, let's go be those guys. And so, anyway, all this to say, so after one of these gigs, there's 10 minutes left in the show, and then they go, okay, come on, Black Crowes, you, how many are you? You know, it's like, it's the band, and if anyone had their wife or girlfriend, I guess, but you know, whatever. They bring us down off the back of the stage, and there's this fleet of Volkswagen vans, and that's the tour sponsor. So that's right. They're all there, and they just go, okay, you guys are all in those back two vans, and it's like 12 vans in two rows of six. They're two by a side, six deep,
mm-hmm.
12 vans, or maybe it was 10, but whatever. That's what it looked like. And we just get in the back two vans of the entourage. And we're like, huh, this is interesting. And we're just sitting there in the dark behind the stage. And you can still
Stones
hear
are playing.
They're playing. You know, they're doing. They finish with Jumpin' Jack Flash. And it's like, it's going. And then, dun, 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 dun. And then you hear this. These fireworks start shooting up from. We're in between the back of the stage and where the fireworks are being launched from. So to my left, I'm seeing firework guns just going. And it's like a fourth.
That's not legit.
Six of them.
It's
like 600 of them. And then to the right is the back of the stage. And you hear a stadium of people going crazy. And then you can hear like, oh, the noise is done. It's just fireworks. They're taking their bows. And then all of a sudden, like the whole area we're in becomes lights up. Like, you know, all these lights go on around us. And down the steps from the back of the stage, here comes Mick, here comes Keith. Every one of those guys has his own van.
Oh, my God.
With, like, his personal assistant or whoever. The singers have – they fill in the rest of the vans.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like they're all moving. They're hustling. And they're surrounded by people hustling them. And the fireworks are still going up, right? And the crowd is still going through. The whole stadium is awash in light and fireworks. And then – I hadn't even noticed this, but the vans are surrounded by police cars and motorcycles, and I got on one count, every one of them hits all their flashing lights. So suddenly we're like, "What the fuck? We're surrounded!"
Right.
And the entire motorcade pulls out of the back of the stadium, and there's like a one lane road that we're on, and then all of a sudden we're on a bigger like an access road, and then up a ramp onto an interstate, like a highway in Switzerland. All of the roads are blocked off. There's no other traffic.
And all the fans are still watching the fireworks.
They're still screaming and watching fireworks.
Ugh.
And within a minute of the first police light turning on, we're pulling onto a highway. It's a dozen, if not 20, police cars, you know, cars and motorcycles. we get onto a highway that the exit, you can see they've blocked off the highway. So when we get on the exit ramp, there's no traffic coming. The whole next stretch of road is blocked off. There's no access. And we are driving at 100 miles an hour in a tight Blue Angel-like formation. And none of us are saying a word. We're all just going, what the fuck?
Yeah, you feel like you're in the Bourne Identity.
Yeah, for real. And just whoo, down the highway for about 6 minutes, tops. And then right off a ramp, all the roads through the town of Basel blocked off. Every road we're on, light can be red, doesn't matter. Whoo, we go right through it, and then we just pull up outside this building that's an unmarked, it just looks like an old 200-year-old wall fortress thing, and all the vehicles just stop, and then the door opens, and we just step out, and then all the stones and everyone's on the sidewalk, like, and they're just all already a million miles away. This is our version of slowly walking to our bus. You know what I mean?
Right.
And then we walk into this through this door that's unmarked, and then we're in a courtyard, and it's just this. They called it a hotel, but it's really just like a palace residence where just the Rolling Stones stay when they're in town, apparently. And Woody had his own apartment, a multi-level. It was like bigger than my house in Atlanta where he lived for his 4 days in town. And we went up there and had a great, great night with him. And then Mick didn't come up, but everybody else did by the end. Mick and Charlie weren't there. Everybody else was. But just that was just one blip.
Mick probably went to go do cardio.
I'm sure he did. That was one blip. I mean, and again, the thing was, it's not just, isn't it cool to be rolling with the Stones? It was just a question of, we thought we had gotten to some great level. And that was like this thing of like, oh, wow, we're still just on the first lap of world as a big band. You know, it was just an incredible thing to like,
I just love the genius.
That's their everyday life for 50 years.
But the genius of the fireworks show, so you're still entertaining them.
Yeah,
you don't get stuck in that, because they literally cause a ridiculous traffic jam. They get out of that. And just the efficiency.
Yeah.
I loved it in the book because you really just described the way it was actually better to hear you say it this way, but just the way it was just like we were behind the stage and then boom, everything just happened and like your head's spinning and then all of a sudden you're just sitting there and Keith's eating his shepherd pie.
Yeah.
Nice show, man.
Well, I mean, we were laughing.
You're in some fucking castle that you would have driven by and never even seen it.
We by the time we got to Woody's room, I promise you, 40 of the 50,000 people in that stadium were still, they're just waiting
walking
for
out.
The waiting for the, you know, to get some leg room to move. They're still just slowly in the aisle, you know, and you're just standing there bumping into the guy in front
people
of you.
People trying to get backstage to meet the band.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, dude, they're
great.
Gone. They're in a castle you're never going to find.
You can't find it.
Yeah,
it
they're already
fantastic.
On their second sandwich.
It was hilarious.
Oh, my God. That's because I remember. I remember Bill Cosby was told the story one time about how George Carlin had like the record as far as like a performer getting out of a venue.
Oh, really?
Like they would still be like, he would be like, I guess, already paid.
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, thanks a lot. You guys are great. All right, see you later. And it was just right out the door in the car and gone. Like he was fucking gone. Like they were still clapping and he was fucking out of that. I thought that was cool. And then to see that, I was just like, I mean, that's like a presidential motorcade you were in.
Oh, 100%.
Where traffic doesn't exist.
That's right.
Rules don't exist. You can drive whatever you want.
And I mean, just imagine, and that's the Stones. I mean, what does U2 do? I mean, there's these bands that are just at that place where there's no getting your arms around how big they are. It's like, you just think about, I saw the other day, something about, you know, Edge has his mountaintop in Malibu compound or wherever he lived out there. And I just thought about it. I was like, what does the Edge do? Like, I'm sure he's got a helicopter to get to town. I mean, you just these guys all
do.
Of course. You get to this point where, like, nothing really applies to you anymore.
But then my thing about that is I don't understand what place do you write from then? When it's like at some point you got to have some dick cut you off in traffic. This fucking asshole today that caused me, my own impatience caused me to fucking scratch the rim of my fucking car. I don't know. Hey, you're also a big sports fan. So believe it or not, we are racing. We're almost halfway through the fucking NFL regular season, which I hate how fast it goes. We're already six games in out of a 16-game schedule.
As a Tennessee Titans fan, I hadn't noticed.
Oh, I know. You guys have. What do you think of the new uniforms? I like them.
I care. They suck.
I
mean,
know,
I mean, win football games, and then I'll tell you look good. Well, are you guys 6-0?
Yes, but we haven't. We've had like Alabama's September schedule so far.
Yeah, right.
I mean, we
right.
played the Dolphins, the Jets, where their quarterback had mono.
Yeah,
just hilarious. Like he went to a prom or something.
That's great.
Played the Redskins. We played the Steelers the first week. Ben was in that week. That was probably our best one. And then we played.
And then
we played Buffalo, who was 3-0, and it was a hard-fought win. So
you said something about Steelers and Patriots just reminded me. You know, we met because you did my podcast in New York City. The first time we met.
That's right, in that hotel room.
Yeah, you came in and did when I was doing a Steve Gorman sports podcast, and we talked a lot about the Patriots and the Steelers and that.
Yeah.
That's like 10 years ago.
Yeah, and we haven't lost to them since then. They beat us one time in one of those horseshit, it's not a catch, but it was a catch.
Yeah, right.
And just for whatever reason. It's just some teams just do well against other teams. Like the Dolphins always beat us at home, and the Broncos have always fucking just been killing us. You know, I forgot. I haven't even said where people can get this. Where they can go to Barnes & Noble's. You can get off your fucking ass and go down to a bookstore.
You
Hard
can do
to
that.
Handle, The Life and Death of the Black Crows by Steve Gorman.
It's wherever you get books. It's literally, it's
And what
it's
about people that have, like, the iPad, but you read books with
yeah,
it? Kindle.
Yeah.
Is that still a thing?
Absolutely. Kindle's a thing. The audiobook is a thing. I read it. I'm the voice of the book if you need 13 and hours and 30
well you
minutes
sent this
me.
Thing to me and I read
you read,
it.
You read it very fast when you first got back to me
and I was doing a movie too
I thought
I
maybe,
was really busy and I just kept I would stay up till 3 in the morning
you texted me and I the first text I went is there a punchline to this because you were like I'm halfway through and I was like I just sent it to you yesterday or whatever it was and I was like
well it's
oh, no,
never
really digging it
you guys were all such characters
yeah
and so everybody in the band, you couldn't really gauge what anybody was going to do
yeah.
from is this guy going to fucking flip out and throw something to is this guy just going to quit out of nowhere
mm-hmm.
that it had that thing, you know, when you binge watch a show.
Yeah.
It's like I
yeah.
binge watched the book.
Well, it's funny because, you know, there's a whole the band went at the end of 2001, the band went away, came back in 2005. And then it went from 5 to 13 with a couple years off in 11 and 12. And I've had a lot of people say, like, man, why didn't you spend so much time on that second part? And I'm like, just fatigue? It's just the same yeah. stories, just changed the names. We had, right. we had a different guitar player.
What's your favorite story that didn't make the book? Were you just like, ah, fuck, I got to
well,
cut
well,
that?
Well, there's a whole chapter that I took out because it really doesn't – it's a standalone episode.
Right.
And I wrote it. I wrote like three times what is the final book. So I've got a shit ton of more material. But there's an entire stand. It was easy to edit it because it just has nothing to do really with anything else. But we got sued by a guy. I'll tell it really quickly. In 1989, we made our first album in the summer of 89.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It's in the can. It's finished. It's done. And then our bass player, Johnny Colt, one day goes, hey, a friend of mine, he's the tour manager for the Georgia Satellites. And the Satellites are kind of done for now, but they rehearse in his house, in his basement. He's got a PA, he's got a drum kit, got the whole thing. I played him the record. He loves it. And he said, if we ever want to rehearse in his house, we free rehearsal anytime. And so now we're at a place where our advance from the label was $5,000.
Jesus.
That's what we got to make Shake Your Moneymaker. So that didn't last long.
That's a kegger.
And by the way, we didn't get it for months. When I got my $1,000 advance, I went to the record store I worked in and I put in my 2 weeks notice. And 3 weeks after I quit, I had to go back to work because I'd spent the $1,000. I quit on Halloween and I was back at Thanksgiving weekend. Hey, guess who's back? And then the day Shake Your Moneymaker was released, I was there putting it in the bins. The day it came out, I was still working at a record store.
And how much later before you could
We hit the road like 3 weeks later. And then I never came home. I mean, we were just out.
Did you have a manager that believed in you or is he like,
oh, yeah.
You'll be back?
No. I mean at the bookstore? I mean at the record store?
What was the name of the record store?
It's called Wax and Facts. It's in Little Five Points in Atlanta. It's still there. I still go there every time I'm in town. The owner, Danny Beard, a dear friend. The manager, Sean Bourne. I lived in his house for a while. I'm still great. It's like I have to go. It's like if I'm in town, I have to go at least walk in and say hi. I can't not. It's my last job.
That's awesome.
Oh, yeah. Great, great guys.
All right. Well, you got to get this book. You got another one?
Well, let me tell you. I didn't finish the story. Real quick.
Oh.
But
I just thought it was cool you were working at a record store putting your fucking thing in. Sorry.
Well, the whole point was this guy that we rehearsed in his basement a couple times, and he's a fun guy, English dude. He's like, oh, I love your band. You're fantastic. And you can't sense when an English guy's an asshole for a while. That accent works. It's pretty jarring. He starts to say, look, satellites are done. I want to manage you. And we're like, you want to manage us? And we didn't have a manager yet. And we said, no, we're going to get a real manager, like a big-time guy, which is who we ended up getting, Pete Angelus, who was amazing. Mm-hmm. But so through the fall of 89, we rehearsed at this guy Kevin's house. And then we said, well, dude, you can be our tour manager. That's what you do. He kept begging us, I want to manage you. I want to manage you. I want to manage you. We kept saying no, no, no. And this whole thing went down where we had to actually kind of get in his face and go, hey, motherfucker, you're not a part of this. You're starting to piss us off. But we also didn't want to lose free rehearsal. So we were navigating this thing. No one ever said, okay, you'll do it. But we did say you can be our tour manager.
But not manager.
Not at all. And in fact, he was with us the night we met Pete. He was there when we hired Pete. And Pete said, you already have a tour manager who's done it? Fucking great. Right. Like Pete was thrilled we had this guy.
So for people listening, tour manager, he's the guy who sets up your travel. Yeah, make sure when the fireworks are going off, everybody gets in the van.
Well, back then, this is what he did. Drive the van. Settle with the club, get them to a hotel. Pretty simple. It's Fisher Price management skills
right.
in that time.
But he's not making business decisions.
No, none whatsoever. Okay. He is given direct orders from the manager, and he's a logistics guy.
Right.
At that time, very simply. Now, you get to a point where the tour manager is huge, but when you're a brand new band on your first tour, it's real easy. Long story short, he quit. His girlfriend had a baby. He didn't know she was pregnant. You can mull that one over for a minute. Big shock to him. He quits. We say, thank God we dodged a bullet.
Wait.
We don't have time. You're a busy man.
Wait, until he had a... We had a
record release party in Atlanta.
Her water broke, and that's when he realized she was pregnant.
He realized she was pregnant when her friend called and said, come to the hospital. She's having a baby.
How long had it been since he'd seen her?
She was drinking with us that night at our record release party.
She fat?
She's not a small woman. But the point is, he quit. This is a whole nother podcast.
Didn't feel the baby kicking?
It's a whole nother podcast.
Wow.
And I remember thinking, what kind of guy lives with a woman and doesn't know she's pregnant? Like, she didn't tell him. She kept it from him. Anyway, that's not my story to tell. My story to tell is, he sued us a year later and said that we had made him a partner in the band and he was entitled to 1/6 of all the profits from Shake Your Moneymaker. And he based his lawsuit on a doodle that I drew on a napkin with a Sharpie. And he said that was our contract. And that went from me in 1989 sarcastically making fun of him for being an emotionally overwrought asshole to him putting us into a courtroom. And it went all the way. And in 1996, we were on court TV for 2 weeks defending ourselves against this guy.
Please tell me you won.
Hung jury, 6-6.
So that means you...
And then we had to settle. We just settled with them.
That's why they do it, because they know you end up having to settle.
And we had a... It's an incredible whole... But anyway, but that whole story in the book is like a standalone chapter. It really doesn't move the narrative of anything, so it was easy to take out. It's like its own separate island.
Did you ever get to talk to that guy and be like, really?
Yeah, yeah. Well, he was threatening to. And we'd see him around town. I was like, Kevin.
I had a project like that.
What are you fucking doing? Not what is wrong with
and
you?
And what did he say?
Look, man, I'm owed. And of course, I'm like, we met you after the record was done. You quit before it was released. So you are entitled to 1/6 of our debt at that time, if anything. We were $90,000 in the hole to the label. What the fuck are you talking about?
Dude, I did something. I'm not going to say what it was, but I did something a while ago. And the one guy involved in it, none of us made any money. Mm-hmm. And the only guy who made money was the guy who fucked up everything and then sued us. So he actually, not only did we not make money off this thing, we ended up losing money. This guy was like, I didn't want to talk about it. All I know is the premiere for the thing, he showed up with a giant like gash on his forehead because he had gotten shit-faced at his house and fell in face first into the fireplace.
Oh my God.
And told us that while he was in like, I'm going to sue you mode.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so in how it works in show business and anything has any litigation attached to it, it won't move forward. He knows that, so he knows we have to settle. And it was just like there's always that fucking guy.
Yeah.
Look, man, I'm old. Oh, hey, you know, well, I'm a fuck up.
Yeah.
And you guys are going to do something with this, and who's going to take care of me? So what killed me is our whole thing went away.
Yeah.
Nothing happened. And this fucking asshole, you know, he made like fucking 10 grand.
He's the guy in Goodfellas that they finally just slit his throat. Like,
oh, Maury's wig. That's why you got to love the mob.
That's right.
My buddy, Verzi always says that. I swear to you, if the guy was in the mob, he'd get fucking whacked. Yeah. And it's kind of the problem with a lot of stuff. Well, before you get out of here, one of my favorite Steve Gorman moments, other than watching you play live, was when you did the Dean Del Rey stand-up and his birthday thing where you played like...
Oh, the AC/DC gig.
Yeah, the AC/DC gig. And I remember everybody showing up, geek, having like a good time. You just fucking show up like you, like the deadpan. How are you? What's going on? And then Dean's like, hey, man, you ready to rock? And this is going to be a great time tonight. And you just said, a great time. And you just pointed out to all the empty seats. You go, you see that out there? That's going to be fucking carnage tonight. This is fucking... We're going to lay waste to these people. I was just like, Jesus Christ. And then I was watching you play. I was having such a fun time watching you play. I forgot that I was going to have to sit in for one.
That you had to play.
Yeah. Which we're not going to talk about that part. But you fucking... Like, I already was such a huge fan of your playing, but to watch you play different material, to see, how is he in this environment and just totally nailed the Phil Rudd thing, man. It was fucking... It was incredible. It's a night I will never forget.
Well, we need to do it again. Is what we need to do.
Well, Dean's
cooking up something.
He's definitely cooking up something. Yeah. There's an anniversary or something coming up, and he's throwing some names around. And that reminds me. I should call him to make sure that I'm not on the road when that goes down, because I definitely want to see that. But I'm so happy for you, man. You got the Steve Gorman Rocks. You got the new Trigger Hippie album.
Steve Gorman Rocks is a classic rock radio show on Westwood One Cumulus. It's syndicated nationwide. Trigger Hippie's album, Full Circle and Then Some, came out last week. It's available everywhere you get music.
And Hard to Handle,
Hard
the
to Handle,
Death
the Life and Death of the Black Crows.
The fucking greatest rock book I ever read.
Thank
as far
you, man.
Is like...
And by the way, the
I
greatest...
I know it's your version.
The greatest...
I know it's your version.
It
but
is.
You gave me, you know...
But you,
your,
sir,
your version.
You, William, provided the greatest blurb. And I can't tell you how many... I've done so many interviews, and they go... The Angela's Ashes of Rock Bios. Everybody says that's the greatest thing I've ever read. It's on the back of the book. Your quote, it's incredible.
If you never read Angela's Ashes, it was about this kid, Irish kid.
It's amazing.
Growing up in Ireland, and it was just this heartbreaking story of his dad was just a raging alcoholic. But every once in a while, he would, like you guys, he'd turn it around. Yeah. Hey, coming, Bill, going out with Jimmy Page, right?
Yeah.
He would fucking get some money, he'd get a job, and then that was the payday. Please just come home. Please come home and feed your family, fix your kid's eye who's got the infection on his fucking eye. And then he was supposed to be home 10 minutes ago. He was supposed to be home 3. And it's just, but every time you had that hope.
Yeah.
Like, there's no way the whole fucking, I forgot it was written by an Irish guy.
Yeah.
So I was like, there's no way the whole book can be this. And it was.
Frank McCourt.
Frank McCourt.
When you sent me that quote, I swear, man, I looked at it and I was overcome with warmth. I was like, that is the greatest compliment anyone will ever pay me for anything I ever do.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Incredible.
Hard to Handle, The Life and Death of the Black Crow. Steve Gorman, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank
you guys,
brother,
for listening. Have a great weekend, you cunts, and I'll talk to you on Monday.
She's told me forever that I have ADD, and I never bought into it. And she finally went to the website, and she read all the things, dude. And it was just like they might as well just had a picture of me sitting there, not listening to somebody, focusing it on some ant walking across the table before looking at something else. Do you have that problem?
I think a lot of myself and a lot of my comedian friends have that. Yeah, I think it's.
And do you think that that's why we think in bits rather than scripts?
I think it's because I think our minds constantly are going. You know, our minds are constantly going, whether it's trying to be creative, whether it's thinking of this, whether it's being upset. We can't concentrate.
I wasn't a good student, but we're no different than anybody else who's scatterbrained, which is funny scatterbrained.
Maybe.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, maybe.
Because they always try to attribute, like they had something recently where they tried to say that, you know, they did, you know, some study. you know, who the nobody knows who the fuck did it, was trying to say that, you know, they interviewed all these comedians, you know, for this study to figure out what makes comedians funny. Now, immediately, I'm thinking any comedian worth anything is not going to be participating in that fucking thing. Or if they're new and they're struggling, they'll participate and they're going to give bullshit answers just to make their friend laugh or themselves laugh.
Right.
So they came up with this whole thing that, you know, comedians are all sociopaths or some fucking...
Oh, I saw that. I didn't like it. Yeah, that's ridiculous.
It is, because I'm not saying there aren't comedians who are sociopaths, but there's firemen, there's mothers, there's all kinds of people that are... There's leaders of the world who are sociopaths. It just... What it is I think it's people who aren't funny. Only somebody who's not funny would try to figure out why the fuck something's funny.
Absolutely.
Like, I wouldn't even know. I wouldn't even, like, when you were talking about that guy at the Yankee game who kept yelling out, they had this commercial where it was a bunch of Yankee fans, you were saying, that had spelt out Yankees across
on their chest. And they were wrong.
Yeah, and they were hammered or whatever, right? Or they just were wrong.
They were just like, they were just in, not organized where it said Yankee, so it said Ansky.
Ansky. So this guy at the game, anytime there was a lull in the game,
there would be a lull in the game, and he would go, hey, what the hell is Ansky? And everybody would just start laughing.
Yeah, and he knew when to do it.
Yes.
Like that guy, that guy was not a comedian, but he had that comic timing when there was a lull in the game.
Yeah, he knew.
It wasn't important.
Yeah.
Time in the game, he knew probably if there was a TV timeout.
Yep.
You know, and he wanted to keep the excitement going and people's focus. Like that, it's like when I look at people who can like just fucking play an instrument unbelievably, play it by ear. You know, that's obviously just a hobby for me. So I have a tremendous amount of respect for people who can do that shit. Mm-hmm. But like, they could never just break down. Would you just sit there and be like, now what makes this guy be able to play the guitar like that? It's just like they're good at it.
It's an envious nerd who can't do it. That's what it is. It's somebody who wish maybe they wish they could do comedy. But the fact that somebody would do a study saying comedians are all sociopaths, that person never picked up a microphone once in their life. And maybe they had an issue with a comedian.
Now, I'm not saying that I'm not a sociopath. But you know, you're a family man. You got two kids.
Listen.
You seem all right.
Listen.
Are you a psycho, Paul?
Comedians might be narcissistic. Sociopath. I looked up the definition of sociopath. Okay, there's like 11 things or something like that you could have.
Dude, let's look this up.
Go
right
it
now.
Up right now.
Look this
okay?
up.
One thing I know for hang a fact, on, antisocial on. Parents is one of them. Okay, parents who, but like I mean antisocial. The world's out to get you. No, we're not going over there. They think this of us. We're not going over
all
there.
All right, check one for me.
What?
Okay. My parents were like that. Hey, can I go on this field trip? No, Christ, I had a patient in the other day. He went on a field trip and he fell off the bus. He's gone. He's gone. There's nothing you can do about it. That was one of my first jokes I did in my act. Whatever you wanted to do, my dad had a patient in the other day, and the kid died from it.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, he didn't want to drive us over to do it.
No, my dad. My dad would do
now it. Now I look at it, it's fucking hilarious. I wouldn't do it either with one kid. Forget about having fucking all the ones he had. Hang on a second. How to spot a sociopath. Wait. Sociopath. Sorry with the bad mic here. Sociopath traits. Which I misspelled. Spelled trats. How to identify a sociopath? Telling signs and behavior. Oh, what the fuck? Why won't this work? Come on, man.
My dad used to say people that when he disagreed with that, they were crazy.
There we go.
Not crazy. They're crazy.
He's a sociopath. All right, here we go. What is a sociopath who gives a fuck? Common traits. All right, the common characteristics and personality traits of sociopaths are based on the criteria used by clinicians who use the DSM. Don't they realize morons want to read this? I don't give a shit. Just make a list.
Yeah, there should be just a list there.
There should. Dumb it down, right? One of the most common personality characteristics of sociopath is their grandiose sense of self-entitlement. Now, I don't have that. I go the other way. Sociopaths also often display a lack of remorse.
Yep.
And most have a very manipulative personality covered by superficial charm. Jesus, I know a couple of those.
Dude, I
know a couple of these guys.
Me too.
All right, now wait a minute. So I'm not...
No, dude, you're a narcissist who has ADD.
Yeah. I would be that. Yeah, I would go with that.
That's yeah.
I would totally go with
that. Yeah, dude, you don't, that's hitman shit. That's hitman.
I don't have a sense of self entitlement.
No, dude, a hitman blows someone's brains out and goes eat a sandwich. That's a sociopath.
Yeah, he gets mad that he got blood on his shirt, right?
Yeah, that was that thing in Goodfellas when he goes, oh, "I'm sorry about your floor." That's it. That's right. What it is.
I didn't want to get blood on the floor.
Kind of sociopaths. Fucked up people today.
All right, friendships and romantic partners are often frequently disregarded and replaced when the relationship no longer suits their self-centered needs. The emotions of a sociopath. No, but even like the guy I was just thinking about being a sociopath, he doesn't have that. Well, I guess, can you have like most of it and then be a sociopath? What do you think there, Dr. Verzi?
I think
not Dr. Verzi being talked to by not Dr. Burr?
No, I think, what's it called? I think that it's the remorse thing, and I definitely think it's the first thing you said, the sense of entitlement. Like
this is the cool one here. Look at this one. Jesus Christ. Cool, like in like a reptilian scary way. The emotions of a sociopath may appear to be sincere on the surface, cleverly disguised by superficial charm and feigned interest. Jesus Christ, that was me in every classroom I ever was in. Sitting there acting like you were interested so they wouldn't fucking call on you. Many sociopaths use manipulative measures to draw others to them. Chronic lying is a characteristic of nearly all sociopaths. Recklessness and aggressive behaviors are other characteristics, as well as impulsivity. A lack of remorse, he already said that, or what is generally termed conscience, is typical for sociopaths. This guy's repeating himself. The combination of at least three of the common sociopath characteristics paints a pretty good description of the common sociopath. I don't know. I actually lost interest halfway fucking through that. All right. It's ADD. It wasn't even trying to be funny. That came out of my mouth, and I realized I just did that again.
Well, no. Why don't you look up a narcissist? See the difference. Because narcissist is a selfishness, but it's almost like a good guy selfishness.
Yeah, but dude, I'm a Gemini, so I have like I can be really like. I mean, I think
my son's a Gemini. Lucas is a
Gemini. But I think I'm mainly a narcissist, but then I can be like really considerate and generous.
That, dude, Lucas, my son Lucas is a Gemini. He's got when you look at what a Gemini's traits are, dude, he's every one of them.
Oh, Jesus Christ! When are you taking out the crystal ball? All right, hang on a second. I love how I brought up fucking...
What do you mean crystal ball?
I love how I brought up Geminis, and then you start talking about signs, and then I act like you brought it up.
Uh-oh.
All right, here. How do you spell narcissist? Come on, Paul. Let's show how dumb we are. N-A-R, narcissism.
I would say N-A-R, maybe what? C-A, maybe?
I would have gone with that if the right spelling didn't come up. Narcissistic...
traits, or...
Let's go with behaviors.
Narcissistic behaviors.
All right.
Because narcissists have remorse.
Do they?
I think so. They feel bad. They suck.
Oh, here we go. I found one that's dumbed down. 30 red flags of being a narcissist. Here we go.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
All right. You feel on edge around this person, but you still want to... But you still want them to like you. What is this? Wait, I gotta figure out what the fuck. Who is you in this? So what's the difference about this list? Well, for one, it's specifically about relationship, but it's also about you. Each point requires introspection and self-awareness. Because if you want to spot toxic people, you cannot focus entirely on their behavior. That's only half the battle. Oh, that's pretty cool. You must also come to recognize the looming red flags in your own heart. All right, so this is saying if you're in a relationship with a narcissist.
Yeah, they don't have a list? They don't just have
Paul, I'm trying to make it easy.
No, I thought they said 30 lists, like 30 things. Nothing?
Well, maybe we can actually use our brains and just figure this out here. Okay, you feel on edge around this person, but you still want them to like you. Two, uses sex as a tool for control. Creepo.
That's sick.
Plasters your Facebook page with compliments, flattery, songs, and poems. They text you dozens, if not hundreds of times per day. You come to rely on this over-communication as a source of confidence.
Wow.
Oh, so they give it to you and then they take it away. You're not texting me 400 times a day. Did I do something wrong?
Oh, then I'm
Is that what they're doing?
No, I'm not.
Yeah, I'm not that.
No.
I can't spell enough words to text more than 30 times a day. All right, quickly declares you their soulmate. I don't do that. Compares you to everyone else in their life. You're just like my mother. Lies. You remind me of my Uncle Petey. Lies and excuses. Lies and excuses.
That's everybody.
No startle response. You know what the fuck? Can you just have a one for dumb people? All right, here we go. Red flag narcissistic behaviors. Jesus Christ, look at the bitch's fucking picture on this.
Holy shit.
Is this about her or is she going to tell me? Okay. Extreme infatuation with oneself. Self-centered. Expects to be recognized as superior.
All right, now you're getting warmer.
Is that you?
Now you're getting warmer. No, I don't want to be superior. I mean, you know.
Extreme infatuation with oneself. Self-centered. Expects to be recognized. Just picture somebody combing their mane in the mirror. Is preoccupied with fantasies of unlimited power, success, brilliance, beauty, or ideal love. Sees himself as special. Dude, this is fucking hilarious. And should only have to affiliate.
Oh, shit. This is funny.
This is a good one. This is a great one. Sees himself as special and should only have to affiliate with others of the similar stature. Hey, I should be friends with that Obama. I can't believe he hasn't called me yet.
That's fucking funny, man.
Takes advantage of others to achieve his needs. Demonstrates, that's an ugly one. The other ones are funny. That's
Wait,
just,
what's the ugly one? What's the one?
Takes advantage of others to achieve his needs. I don't like that one. No. That other shit, just staring in the mirror thinking
you're the shit. No, just thinking you should be friends with everybody. Like, it was big.
Demonstrates a constant need for admiration or approval. You know, my dad used to, he'd be upstairs shaving.
Yeah.
And it was sort of a joke, but he wasn't joking, but he was. It was funny.
Yeah.
We'd be downstairs eating breakfast or something, be up there getting ready for work, and he'd be shaving in the mirror. And then when he finished, you'd just hear him, he'd be like, "Good looking son of a bitch." And my mother would always laugh and shake her head. But I think that's more, she just liked a confident guy or something like that. So
I think that sounds kind of like a joke, like a half
that's
joke.
A joke.
Yeah, yeah, he's playing.
But he's saying it out loud. But I do that. Makes Nia laugh all the time. I'll do it. I'll do that.
That's great.
I'll just be like, God damn it, I'm a good looking guy. I'll just do shit like that.
Yeah.
Like, oh, shut up, right?
Yeah.
There we go. Everybody's going to text me, what a fucking ugly bastard I am. Like, I don't know that already. Fuck yourselves. Demonstrates a constant need for admiration or approval. Exaggerates personal achievements while minimizing those of others. That's fucking hilarious. I want to be around this guy. I'll tell you, you know, it was great. It's great the way you came up with the game plan, but
I was just gonna say
the way I was cheering in the crowd, I got this chant going. And I tell you, I could see it in Tom Brady's face. He knew. Yeah. He knew by what I was doing in the crowd that.
Yeah. And then he tries to knock the other guy's chant.
He called an audible, you know, which I wouldn't have done. I would have stuck with the play.
And then, no, but then it says he diminishes the other guy.
That's great.
Other guy's chant was all right, but I got more of them going.
Yeah.
And
that guy came up to me at the end of the game
and
was
he
just
said,
like,
you were great.
I don't usually say this, but you were amazing.
Keep going. This list is great.
You know why this is? It's because this reminds me of so many guys I used to hang out with and gamble with and all that type of shit. Like, all these guys, like, this is a brutal. If you're a narcissist and you walk into a fucking casino, it's fucking brutal because you're going to walk in thinking you're James Bond and you have this system and you're going to take the whole fucking house down.
Yeah, I got to tell you, there's nothing funnier than that one that you read that said that they think they're superior so they should only be hanging out with people that are superior. That is so fucking
it's
funny.
Fucking hilarious, yeah.
Ugh.
All right, is convinced that he/she is unique.
Yeah.
I like how that just suggests, that just takes it. We're all special. This website's like, no, you're not. Feels entitled to special treatment and that rules frequently don't apply to him. I don't have the first half, but I have the second half.
Oh, yeah.
I have problems with authority. I definitely do. I told you that story, right? Where I didn't. I told you that fucking story.
Great.
Oh, yeah. I didn't get caught either.
That's great.
My proposed love and marriage within only a few weeks. Within only a few weeks of starting a relationship. That definitely wasn't me. very charismatic or charming at first, but can quickly switch from Dr. Jekyll to Mr. Hyde. This fucking lady, these are all just the same thing over and over again. Oh, wait. Panics, cries, begs, and becomes emotional if he anticipates an end to a relationship.
That's not
I
me.
I swear to God, I'll pay attention to you more.
I was wrong.
What do you want me to do?
I love you. I was wrong.
May harass or stalk you if you do break up. Oh, because he wants to be the one who breaks up, or she. Quick to anger or feel insulted or slighted. Rages with anger or inflicts the silent treatment when upset. Ding, 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 ding. I got that. Quick to anger. I got that. I wouldn't stalk somebody. Denies he slash she has issues to work to work on. That's fucking sees himself herself as nearly perfect. I fucking love this guy. What are you talking about? What are you talking about?
That's so funny.
Maybe you ought to work on yourself. Adapt around me. Drives recklessly and way too fast. Exaggerates the truth or blatantly lies. Dude, I want to be around this guy and just listen to him tell stories. This is the funniest shit. Rarely treats anyone with respect or kindness. Doesn't acknowledge or respect others' boundaries. Always wants to be in control. May drink and drive regularly. Yeah, because he doesn't give a fuck about other people. His slash her need for attention, time, and space matter. His need for time, for attention, time, and space matter. Your needs do not. let me just read one more of these before this gets boring. Uses sex as a weapon through withholding, controlling, or being overly demanding. I said, suck it. It's the best dick ever. Doesn't appear to have a conscience. Does not take criticism well and becomes easily defensive. Is easily hurt and insulted. Jesus Christ. That was a fucking hilarious list.
Not really funny.
That is funny though, huh? Sees himself as fucking superior and should only be hanging around superior beings.